Good morning. I'm Glenn Moberg in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network, our guest for the next hour. In our Wisconsin Public Radio studio in his hometown of Wausau, longtime Congressman Dave Obey, a Democrat who has represented North Central Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District for 41 years. Mr. Obey announced his retirement last May, and in November, his congressional seat was won by a Republican, former Ashland County District Attorney Sean Duffy, in a wave that put Republicans in charge of the U.S. House of Representatives and also in charge of the Wisconsin Governor's Mansion and both houses of the state legislature. We're going to ask Mr. Obey for his impressions about the new political balance of power and whether it endangers the achievements of the 111th Congress, including Mr. Obey's signature issue, health care reform. We'll also talk about the proposals in Washington to cut the deficit and what that might mean for Social Security and Medicare. And we'll talk in broader terms about Mr. Obey's 41 years in Congress, the things he's proudest of, the things that he regrets, and the things that have changed for the better and for the worse during that time. Well, we've got a very full plate today, and we'd like you to sit down and join the feast. Give us a call if you'd like to talk to retiring Congressman Dave Obey at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Congressman Obey, thanks so much for making your time available. And it's good to see you here in your hometown of Wausau.
Good to be here.
Let's start out with the 111th Congress. It certainly ended with a bang. The tax cut compromise and the unemployment extension, the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, ratification of the START Treaty, medical benefits for 9/11 workers, a major new food safety bill. All these things happened in the U.S. Senate. I'm aware that you have no control over that, but as an observer, how do you explain the flurry of activity in these last few weeks of what had been a very snail's pace sort of Senate during the past 2 years?
Well, I think it simply lies in the change in behavior of the Republicans in the Senate. All of those things that you talked about had already passed the House. When they got to the Senate, virtually every issue that was brought up by the Democratic majority, the Republican minority filibustered, which meant that you had to have 60 votes to pass them, and we didn't have 60 votes. I think after the election was passed, the Republicans lost their incentive to be obstructionist on those issues, and they simply backed off, which allowed a few moderate Republicans to vote their conscience instead of the party line, and that's why we got the work done.
How do you feel about the tax cut compromise, specifically the portion of it that cut those tax rates for the next 2 years for the wealthiest Americans?
Well, virtually everybody in the Congress, save perhaps about 5%, was in support of the tax cuts for average people in order to help keep the economy moving for the next 2 years. I was very much opposed to two items. I was opposed to the idea that we should give a supersized tax cut to people who make over $250,000, and I was opposed to the huge amount that was exempted from the estate tax. People were confused on the $250,000 item. Many people thought that what we were proposing is simply to say, if you make $250,000 or above, you get nothing. That's not what we were proposing. What we were proposing is to say that the amount of tax relief that you got would be capped at the amount that came from a $250,000 income. And it just amazed me that in the last week, the last act of the Senate Republicans was to try to cut back by 38% the effective support we provide for Pell Grants. They wanted to cut the maximum grant by 38% to save about $5.5 billion. And keep 500,000 kids off out of Pell Grants, and yet they were willing to spend $110 billion on tax cuts for the very wealthiest people in this society. I think that's backwards.
Do you feel that those tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, was that a decent trade-off considering all that the Democrats got during the remaining couple of weeks of the session?
Well, it wasn't tied to everything we got. It was tied to what else was in the tax bill. I believe that the House tried to change it by changing the estate tax item. we recognized we didn't have the votes in the Senate to take on the other piece. But I believe that we could have gotten more, especially on the estate tax side, if we'd held out. So I was in basic support of the package except for those two items.
Some are saying that the 111th Congress ranks up with the New Deal of FDR in 1932 and the Great Society of LBJ in 1964 as the most productive and significant Congresses in the past 100 years. Do you share that assessment?
I don't think there's any doubt about it. I mean, you can argue about whether you like what the Congress did or not, which is a perfectly legitimate debate to have. But the fact is, the one thing you cannot call this Congress is a do-nothing Congress. I mean, this Congress stuck its neck out day after day after day doing big things, which will have a terrific impact down the road. The problem is that the country was being so pounded by the bad economic conditions that Obama inherited and which were not being mitigated fast enough. And secondly, the country was so frustrated watching the Senate screw up a two-car funeral when it came to the way they handled the health care bill, adding all of these special deals that we later ripped out, but the public never recognized that those special deals were largely ripped out. And so I think that's why the public support for the Congress is very different than you would expect, given what it got done.
You think the sausage making regarding the health care bill soured a lot of people on health care reform, or was it the individual mandates? Those seem to be very unpopular with a lot of people.
Well, I mean, human nature is funny. Everybody wants the medicine that tastes good, but nobody wants the medicine if it doesn't taste good, even if it's effective. You have to understand. I don't like the mandates. I would much rather have had a single payer. I would much rather have had a public option. But we got beat on those issues. And the fact is that the insurance companies would have blocked everything. They would have blocked everything if you had not had the mandate to purchase insurance, because then the insurance companies would have said, gee, if people don't have to buy insurance, then they won't get insurance until they get sick. Then when they get sick, they'll come and buy an insurance policy, and it will drive the cost of health care through the roof.
Let's look
so
at this.
You could not let that happen, which is why the mandates were in there. I think that was a crucial part of finally beating the insurance companies on something.
Let's look at this litany of things that you passed: health care reform, Wall Street reform, credit card reform, student loan assistance, saving the American auto industry, the American Recovery Act, which you helped write in the House Appropriations Committee. All those accomplishments, and what did you end up achieving? A landslide Republican midterm victory, sweeping the Democrats out of power in the House, putting Republicans in control, not only in the U.S. House of Representatives, but also in Wisconsin, in the governor's mansion, in both the state Senate and the state assembly, a pattern repeated all over the country. If all that stuff was so good, why'd you lose the election?
Because if you look at all of the polling, what it shows is that the public was in such agony over what was happening in the economy. They had so little confidence in the system because of what was happening in the economy that they wanted to, and they were so dissatisfied with the pace of economic recovery that they were trying to send a strong message, and I don't blame them. I mean, it's not an academic exercise to somebody in a community like this one. If your brother loses his job, or if your daughter loses her job, that's real stuff, and people just didn't see recovery coming fast enough. And I think that's the main reason. The second main reason, I think, is because the Senate was so spectacularly stupid in the way that it held ransom that health care bill forever, while every two-bit wacko idea that some senator had initially got stuck into the bill in order to buy votes. And the public just got fed up with that nonsense, as did those of us in the House. And the public never became aware of the fact that 90% of that garbage was tossed out before the final package.
Conservatives say that your stimulus bill, the one that you helped write, was not successful and did not do the job that was promised.
Well, the fact is that when it passed, I made the point that I thought it was not adequate to the task at hand because the economy was in much worse shape than people seem to think it was. We had a $3 trillion hole in that economy. And the problem we faced is that the White House was, I think, significantly incompetent in the way it communicated to the public why it was necessary to have short-term, and I emphasize short-term, deficit spending. The White House did a lousy job of explaining in plain English to the average citizens of this country that what they were planning was a temporary action to get the economy moving until the private sector could recover. And so the public looked at that spending and thought, gee, it's not having enough of an effect. It didn't, but it did help change from losing 750,000 jobs a month to gaining a few thousand jobs each month.
Do you think
that's not nearly enough, but it certainly is a whole lot better than it would have been without that action.
Do you think your stimulus bill helped keep America from a second Great Depression?
I don't think there's any doubt about it for people who understand economics. And I will say something else. George Bush takes, Barack Obama takes a lot of heat for the TARP bailout of Wall Street that passed. And I'm going to say something that's very unpopular, which is nothing new for me. But the fact is that Wall Street bailout was not Obama's package. It was George Bush's package, and George Bush was right to do it. It was a very unpopular thing. But at the time, we had a choice between doing nothing and watch all the credit markets in the country freeze up and hitting 20% unemployment, or providing some temporary help to some idiots on Wall Street who really screwed up everything that they touched. Anybody who voted for that package hated to do it, but it was, in my view, an act of high statesmanship on Bush's part to recognize that you had to do something to stop the bleed, or you would have had a huge increase in unemployment above the levels that we had.
And
that money has largely now been repaid, another fact which the public has not been told about.
Mr. Obi, we have had, since all of that was passed, about a 5,000-point increase in the stock market from the depths of it was down to about 6,500. Why didn't the Democrats make more of that in the run-up to the last election? If you had told anybody 2 years ago, when the stock market was at 6,500 points and in free fall, that within just 2 years it would be up above 11,000, they would have thought you were crazy. But yet I never heard any Democrat make that argument in the run-up to the election.
Because I don't think it would have worked because two things. Number one, most people are more concerned about the job market than they are the stock market. And secondly, they're concerned about what you're going to do in the future, not what you did in the past. The public get very fast. The public tires of debates about the past. They want to know what you've got in mind, what you're planning in order to make the future better.
We're talking to Congressman Dave Obi, Democrat from North Central Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District. We're going to take a short break. I'm Glenn Moberg in for Kathleen Dunn this morning, and we will be taking your phone calls at 1-800-642-1234 right after this. I'm Glenn Moberg in for Kathleen Dunn on this Tuesday morning. Our guest today, Congressman Dave Obi, and we are broadcasting this morning from his hometown of Wausau at the Wisconsin Public Radio Studio at UW-Marathon County, taking your phone calls at 1-800-642-1234. Dave, you held on to the 7th District Congressional seat for 41 years, and now it's in the hands of a Republican, Sean Duffy. Why, in your view, didn't Democrats keep that seat in what you have called a very progressive district?
Well, let me say it was 41 years and 9 months, so don't squeeze that one out of me. I don't want to comment on the last election. I mean, the public has a right to vote for anybody they want, and I think that for the moment, out of courtesy to the new person in that seat, I ought to just let him get settled and evaluate what he does.
What are your hopes for Mr. Duffy in the Republican-controlled Congress in the next 2 years?
Again, I don't want to refer to my successor. That's let the public decide that over time. What I would hope would happen in the Congress and in the White House is that there would be a much more aggressive effort to deal with the specifics of job creation. Secondly, I would hope that we would recognize the futility of the war in Afghanistan. And thirdly, I would hope that we would have some serious discussion about how you attack the deficit without destroying the ability of the economy to grow over time. You have to do what we did under Bill Clinton in the 90s when we had selective spending reductions, but coupled with the kinds of investments in education, in science, and things like that, job training. We have a huge mismatch problem between jobs available and skills that are possessed by workers looking for jobs. We do very much less on the job training front, both public and private, than most other countries in the world, and that's going to kill us internationally.
I'm going to ask you one more question about the results of the last election before we move on to our phone calls. Here in Wisconsin, our new governor, Scott Walker, has killed the high-speed rail link between Madison and Milwaukee, which was an item that you fought for on a federal level. Your reaction to that?
One of the most mindless decisions I've ever seen any politician make, in my view. And this is the third time that Wisconsin has done something like this. Back during the Depression, many communities had a chance to get federal money to build schools under FDR's time. And they turned it down because they thought federal money was dirty money. That was event number one. Number two, back in the 50s, when President Eisenhower was passing the highway bill, Wisconsin was choosing between three options in terms of the mileage they wanted to get in the interstate system. Governor Kohler tried mightily to convince the legislature to support a 2-cent gas tax so that you could build not only 90 and 94, but 51 and 29 and some other highways as well to four-lane status. And the legislature turned it down. In the end, they selected the smallest of the three options available in terms of mileage, which is why it took Tom. When I was elected to Congress, Wisconsin, as a result of that decision, was only getting back about 73 cents for every dollar we sent to Washington on highway, on gas tax money for highway construction. It took Tom Petri and I and Jim Moody about 8 years to try to turn that around. And now we have this situation where Wisconsin stood to get over $800 million from the federal government for high-speed rail. And Mr. Walker said we couldn't afford it because he didn't want to pay the $7 million a year in operating expenses. I mean, the numbers speak for themselves. And you need to understand that we spend much, much more on highways than we do on high-speed rail.
Mr. Walker says the high-speed rail system was a boondoggle that nobody would ride.
Well, with all due respect, every other location in the country, virtually every other state in the country except two, are going hard after that money because they know what it can mean in terms of modernizing a regional economy. You have to look at this not just in terms of what Wisconsin gets, but you have to look at it in terms of how much more competitive it makes us when you put a network that is in Illinois, Ohio, Wisconsin, Minnesota. When you put that all together, that makes that region a whole lot more efficient from a transportation standpoint. And if you could then, in Wisconsin, if you could have run that next leg from Madison through Eau Claire to Minneapolis, as Congressman Oberstar and I wanted to do. And then if you had tied that to a link from the Twin Cities to Duluth, You would have taken care of the fact that many parts of my district have lousy air service, and the business community and other people need a much more efficient way, for instance, to get from Eau Claire to your larger cities. And now that opportunity is out the window. It's a shame.
Congressman Dave Obey with us this morning on the Kathleen Dunn Show. I'm Glenn Moberg in for her. We have a lot of people who have been patiently waiting on the phones, and let's get to them right now. Our first caller is Carl in Portage. Carl, you're on the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Yes, good morning, Congressman. Thank you for your 41 years and 9 months of service. I have to ask you, why does the Democratic Party consistently allow itself to get rolled by the Republicans, to be blindsided by the Republicans time after time after time again? Example, Scott Brown being replaced, replacing Senator Kennedy. That was a disaster. I mean, that's just one example of many. Why?
Well, I can't speak to the Scott Brown situation. I'm no expert on Massachusetts politics. I think things were pretty clear there. That election came at a time when people were expressing maximum anger over their confusion on the health care bill. And at the same time, you had a pretty lousy candidate who didn't think that she had to get out and work. And those two, the combination of those two things spells disaster.
Carl, thanks so much for the phone call. Let's go to George in Milwaukee. George, you're on the Kathleen Dunn Show with Congressman Dave Obey.
Hi, and thanks also for your great work in Congress over the years. Some of us who consider ourselves progressives think that our Democratic presidents, Carter, Clinton, Obama, haven't spent enough effort articulating a progressive agenda and thus building up enough public support to help pass something like a single payer. And we've settled for a lot less in watered down programs and legislation. Am I being naive in thinking that this could possibly make a difference?
Look, I would like to have seen the health care package be even more more aggressive than it was. But I want to tell you a story, because the very same criticism was leveled against FDR when Social Security was passed. From 1930 to 1938, this district was represented by a fellow by the name of Jerry Boileau. Jerry was a progressive La Follette Republican, and after Fiorello LaGuardia left the Congress to become mayor of New York, Boileau became the floor spokesman for the progressive Republicans. And in 1938, he was beat. Years later, I ran into him and had a long discussion with him. And I said, Jerry, what beat you in 38? He said, senior citizens beat me because I voted for Social Security. I said, what on earth are you talking about? That makes no sense. Seniors wouldn't be against Social Security. He said, well, in my district, in those days, a lot of them were, because he said FDR had set up Social Security as a contributory plan, so everybody would have to contribute to it. And Doc Townsend, who was leading a counter-movement in California, simply wanted to toss that out and do a $100 a month welfare grant to every senior. And he said, I stuck with Roosevelt, and I opposed the Townsend plan. And he said, old man Townsend came into this district, organized a bunch of Townsend clubs, and they beat me. What's the moral of the story? The story is that today we look back at Social Security. We cannot imagine this country without it. And with all of the little fights that they had at that time about the shape of that program, you know, nobody cares about that now. You've got the basic program. I think the same thing is true with the health care bill that we passed. I mean, people now, they can say, oh, we didn't get public option. We didn't get single payer. The fact is, we got 30 million more people covered by insurance, and we've got some leverage on insurance companies, which over time will help to slow down cost increases, and it's going to make a tremendous difference in the quality of health care and the way health care is delivered in this country. And all of these other little theological debates 30 years from now, we won't even remember them.
George, thanks so much for the phone call. Are you saying that maybe 5 years from now, this health care bill will be as popular with seniors as Social Security is now, when Social Security wasn't popular with seniors when it was passed?
I don't think anything will be as popular as Social Security, but I think 5 years from now, when it goes into effect and people can see that all of this nonsense about death panels and all of that other bull gravy, when people can see that stuff just was not true, and when they see the benefits that come from not letting insurance companies knock you off because of pre-existing conditions and the other limitations on insurance company actions, I think that it will be a very popular piece of legislation.
We've got a couple of emails from listeners who are addressing the health care issue, so let's try to get to those right now. David, who couldn't stay on the line, wanted to know if, Dave, if you think the health care bill was presented wrong, should they have gone for a single payer first? And Tom in Wausau asks, why couldn't Congress have expanded Medicare to include those who can't get private insurance coverage, either through cost or pre-existing conditions, and establish premiums on a sliding scale? Wouldn't it have been easier to take something that was already set up, Medicare, and simply expand it to more people?
If it had been easier, we would have done it. The fact is that we got a double and triple hernia trying to pass that sucker. I'm amazed at the fact that liberals do not seem to recognize that Obama has done what FDR couldn't do, what Harry Truman couldn't do, what Lyndon Johnson couldn't do, what Bill Clinton couldn't do. He got it done. Now, it may not be exactly the design that they'd hoped, but the fact is that you got the job done. I mean, the answer, why didn't we do it another way? Because we didn't have the votes. We didn't have the support. So it's like football. If you're a halfback and you got the ball in your hands, you go where the hole is in the line. And that's the way legislation is always developed. You take the opportunity that presents itself at the time, and then over time you can change it and strengthen it and refine it, which is what will happen with this. Social Security has been modified numerous times. And the same thing will happen to this health care program.
You now have more than a 60-vote Republican majority in the Congress. They control spending. Are you worried, as somebody who supported health care reform, that they're going to try to choke reform before it gets established simply by denying the funding for it?
They will try to defund it. And one of the first things they will do is to try to go after the budget increases that we had to try to put more money into training more doctors, more nurses, more physicians' assistants. Even without health care, we needed to have more people going into the health care field than were. We were developing some shortages. And with health care, we're going to have to pay even more attention to that. That's one of the first things they will go after. And I think we just have to resist that mightily because we need more general practitioners, we need more family doctors, we need more dentists, and you get what you pay for. You've got to develop those professional skills that will not only help on the healthcare front, but it will also help on the job front.
1-800-642-1234 if you want to talk to Congressman Dave Obey, representing North Central Wisconsin's 7th Congressional District and retiring after 41 years and 9 months in Congress. I'm Glenn Moberg in for Kathleen Dunn on Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network. Let's go back to the phones. Lee in Spooner, you are on the air with Dave Obey. Hello, Lee.
Yes. I wanted to, first of all, thank Representative Obey for his service. I voted for him many times. But I promised myself in this past election that I would not vote for a Democrat in either this election or the next election, because I just simply don't believe that the Democrats as a whole represent the interest of wage-earning Americans anymore. And again, I want to thank Representative Obey for his service. And that's it.
Well, Lee, before you go, if Democrats don't represent wage-earning Americans, who does?
I really don't believe they do. I think it's a case of the Rich People's Party and the Rich People's Business Party, and neither of them has any interest in wage-earning Americans.
So who do you vote for now?
No one. It's a case of I can't vote for the Republicans, and I won't vote for Democrats that aren't doing their job.
Well, I wish we had a magic wand so that every time that we have a majority of Democrats voting for something, that meant it would pass. I don't see, frankly, why you blame the Democrats for the fact that we had a majority of Democrats and we had a majority of people in the United States Senate voting for more fair taxation, voting for better health care, voting for better support for education, more support for job training, but were blocked in achieving those because the Republicans used their minority to filibuster us to death. We cannot control the fact that the Republicans had more than 40 votes in the Senate to block all those things. So if you want to shoot the people who have been championing your cause, be my guest, but that's a way to wind up being a long-term lifetime loser.
Lee, thank you so much for the phone call. Dave Obey, you mentioned the filibuster. The U.S. Senate apparently is going to consider filibuster reform on January 5th when they reconvene. What do you think that's going to mean? Do you think it's going to happen?
I think the odds are against it, but I think the previous caller demonstrates why that is necessary. In a democracy, if a democracy is to function, you have to have two things. You have to have an informed electorate, number one. And number two, you have to have accountability in the system. If there is no accountability, or if the rules of the game confuse people about who caused this and who caused that, then the public cannot cast an informed vote and the democracy gets screwed up. In the Senate, the fact that if you get 55 votes out of 100 and still lose, the Democrats are in control, but they still haven't been able to push it through because the filibuster turns a minority into a majority. That destroys people's ability to figure out who in God's green earth did what, and that screws up democracy. So I think it's important that a majority eventually be able to work its will, even if I don't like the product that's produced. So I would hope that Senator Harkin and others who are behind this, and Senator Udall, I would hope they would succeed in anything. I've had senators say to me, Obie, keep your nose out of this. This is a Senate matter. And my response is, no, it ain't, buddy, because half the time it's getting in the way of things that we have already passed in the House, and you have minority control in the Senate, which frustrates everything. I just think it's imperative for the country to understand who stands where. And they can't know that if a minority is going to win all the time.
Is a Senate, in your view, irreparably broken? It is a profoundly undemocratic institution. It was actually designed that way. But critics say it makes a mockery of the concept of one person, one vote. Because a guy voting in Wyoming, his vote counts 10 to 20 times what a person who lives in California.
I don't happen to like that, but I don't believe anything is irreparably damaged. I'm not that much of a pessimist. And if we don't like the fact that that in Wyoming or Rhode Island, they get two senators, even though they have just a fraction of the population of larger states, well, we'll have to take that up with the founding fathers because that's the way they designed it. It was one of those compromises that was necessary to put the government together in 1789. And so it's just like health care. It may not be the ideal system, but it was compromises like that that enabled our founding fathers to cobble together a process which has stood this country in pretty good stead over the years. So I just think we need to put enough pressure on the Senate as a body so that they make some of these reforms. They've reformed the filibuster twice in their history, and I think it's time for a third reform.
Congressman Dave Obey, 1-800-642-1234. He's retiring after 41 years and 9 months representing the 7th Congressional District in North Central Wisconsin. I'm Glenn Moberg in for Kathleen Dunn. We'll be back after this short break. I'm Glenn Moberg in for Kathleen Dunn on this Tuesday morning, and we have here in our Wausau studio at University of Wisconsin, Marathon County, a place that Dave Obey graduated from. Dave, can I ask you how many years ago that was?
About 1,000.
And he is with us for another 17 minutes, taking your phone calls at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go back to the telephones. Eden in Oconomowoc, you're on with Dave Obey.
Yes. My name is Artemis Suarez Eden, Congressman Obey of WisconsinLovesJustice.com. WisconsinLovesJustice.com. I want to thank you for being a workhorse for all those years and inspiring people like me to the point where I'm running for the Senate in 2012, focusing on justice for children and children for justice. I think the conversation has become so complicated that we've forgotten that the whole point is to create a world that does justice for our kids, because they represent the sacrifice of the present and the hope for the future. And if we saw everything through the lens of how would it affect our children, I think our culture would really be transformed. Congressman, do you remember the Midwest Airline hostile takeover that happened 3 years ago and the role that you played by joining with your colleagues in a full-page ad that appeared in the Milwaukee Journal taking a stand for the hometown airline? Do you remember that?
I remember working with Senator Cole on it, yes.
Right. Well, I'm the one who started Wisconsin Loves Midwest Airlines. As a former New Yorker and a Wisconsinite by choice, and achieved that, having both senators, the governor, and the entire congressional delegation, plus the Chamber of Commerce and the Greater Milwaukee Foundation, on one page. And I asked everybody not to put Republican or Democrat, and you did it. And you united for the one company that represented our identity, the Midwest. But that company disappeared. And my question to you is this. What is your opinion on the accountability of executives that essentially are contributing to the disappearance of our economic vitality? You know,
Eden, we have a lot of callers. I want to give Dave Obey a chance to answer your question.
Well, I thank you for your concerns about justice. I think that has to be at the key of everything government does, is a concern about fairness and justice. I fault more than the CEOs. I fault those in government who allow incentives to continue to stay on the books that provide incentives for businesses to move their jobs overseas, such as moving the Polaris, for instance, moving their jobs to Mexico out of Polk County, and I think it's policies like that have led to the situation in which if you take a look at what's happened to real income in this country over the past 20 or 30 years. Since 1980, the average middle-income family, in real dollar terms after you adjust for inflation, is earning about $9,000 less than they were earning then. And yet the average household in the top 1% is earning $740,000 more than they would have in 1980. That's been the largest transfer of income up the income scale in the history of the country. And I think that is why so many Americans have lost confidence in government, because They recognize that government policies have helped put the economic elite on the gravy train while the middle class has been ripped off in spectacular fashion.
We have an email comment from John asking, how can Democrats reclaim the rhetorical and public relations offensive from the Republicans? The Democrats are swimming upstream in all of the conservative media and the Citizens United ruling. We also have an email from Joe in West Bend. I think the obnoxious conservative talk show programs, these are his words, have done a lot to influence national elections and attitudes. Do you agree?
Well, I think that the atmosphere today is certainly a lot tougher than it was in years past. No president that I know of before Obama has ever had to run into the blatant opposition of a news network. I hesitate to call Fox News a news network, Fox News is nothing but an organization that promotes a conservative political agenda every second that they're on the air. And that's very tough if you're in the White House or in public life and you're trying to compete with that. Secondly, I think the court decision, which came down recently, there's nothing new about rich people trying to control politics. That's happened since the country started.
You're talking about the Citizens United decision.
Yes, but that decision, for the first time, creates the conditions that may make it possible for the economic elite to literally buy the system. Harry Truman said once, some people love the government of the United States so much they'd like to buy it. And that decision will allow corporations to spend any amount that they want to spend to influence elections anonymously without the public even knowing where the money is coming from. That totally destroys accountability in the system and makes it almost impossible for average citizens to cut through all of that garbage that you see in those 30-second TV ads to try to find a kernel of truth in the debate.
I'm Glenn Moberg in for Kathleen Dunn, talking to Congressman Dave Obie on this Tuesday morning. And Dave, just a disclaimer, I actually worked for Fox News 20 years ago in Chicago. Let's go back to Claude in Madison, who I think has a question on the same theme.
Hi, Dixon.
Yeah, Claude, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a comment. Last time he was a Republican talking about the $810 billion for the speed rail, railroad. Oh, I intervened and I made a comment because I lost my job and I was looking for jobs. I had offers in Milwaukee, 3 offers, and I couldn't go because my family is in Madison, and I think it's a train would take me over there for 45 minutes. I would be willing to take such a job. And he was so rough. He told me that if I was willing to pay $50 one way. And I couldn't make a comment because he was too rough. So I thought to myself, how is it that those people that we voted will make us pay $50 to go to Milwaukee and come? Would it be just for the luxury to have a sea train or what?
Claude, thanks so much for the phone call. Let's let the congressman answer your question.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know your situation, so I can't comment on it except to say that I hope that you find success in getting a job. There's nothing that destroys people's confidence.
It sounded to me like Claude was saying if there was affordable public transportation between Milwaukee and Madison, he'd take it and get a job.
Well, I mean, the problem is that lots of things aren't affordable to average middle-income people these days. I think that obviously affordable transportation is very important. If you don't have the money to get to where the job is, that job, for all practical purposes, doesn't exist for you.
And he was saying high-speed rail might have been an option.
Well, I mean, it might have been, but as I say, I don't know enough about his situation to know whether there were other reasonable options available or not. But I wish you luck, sir.
Let's go to Dave in Superior. Dave, you're on with Congressman Dave Obey.
Yes. Hopefully, again, the Democrats will be in power in the House. Why, Dave, if they were in power, you would be chairman of House Appropriations. You could direct money, hopefully, to finally build an expressway around Duluth Superior. Why didn't you stay in the House? Why did you retire?
Because I think 48 years of public service is long enough, and I think I'll just let it go at that. I've fought many a battle, and we brought a lot of good things to Superior and many other communities in this district. But sooner or later, it's time for somebody new to take over. And with the passage of health care, I thought this is a good time to step aside. I had wanted, when I was first elected a long time ago, I wanted three things. I wanted stronger support for education. I wanted health care that covered everybody. And I wanted I wanted the kind of tax policy and economic policy that would produce fair income growth across the economy. We certainly never got the latter. In fact, things have gone backwards. But the other two, we've achieved at least to some degree, and I'm happy to pass the baton on to someone else.
Dave and Spooner seem to be saying that he would have liked another one of your famous earmarks, in this case for highway improvements in the Spooner area. There seems to be universal condemnation of earmarks these days, both from Republicans and even from most Democrats. Yet the earmarks you sponsored, Mr. Obey, throughout the years brought hundreds of millions of dollars worth of projects to the 7th Congressional District. What's your take on the fact that there is universal condemnation of the very thing that made voters elect you year after year after year?
Well, let me give you an example. A new Republican who was just elected to the House approached Congressman Don Young, a returning Republican, and he said, Don, I'm going to need your help with this Army Corps of Engineer project in my district. I've got to get funded. And Congressman Young said, didn't you sign that petition opposed to earmarks? Well, this was an earmark, you idiot. That was what he said. And the response from the new incoming member of Congress was, no, it wasn't an earmark. It was a project. I mean, I will make you a flat prediction. The Republicans right now are claiming in the House that they will not support earmarks. But the fact is, you are going to see all kinds of Republicans try to earmark funds for the Army Corps of Engineers or for a number of other agencies, because that's the only way that they're going to do anything other than allow the White House, a Democratic White House, to decide where every last dollar goes. And I don't think they're going to be very comfortable with that. There has been abuse of the earmark process for a number of years. The fact is that nobody did more to reform the earmark process than I did, and I'm doggone proud of that. I put a year's moratorium on earmarking until we could get the system cleared up. You can't have any more anonymous earmarks under my new rules. They've got to be out there in the public for people to see them. I stand by every earmark I ever got to this district. I don't think people in this community would say they'd prefer that our arts block hadn't gone forward. I don't think they'd say that they'd prefer we hadn't modernized the highway system around Wausau. I don't think they'd say they don't want the technical college nursing facility that we got built here. I don't think they'd say that they don't want the new building we got at the university campus right here. I don't think they'd say they want to give up the after-school programs. I don't think they'd say that they want to give up the funding we got for the university at Stevens Point for the Natural Resources Department. So, I mean, like anything else, you can attack something in the generic, but check the specifics, line by line, item by item, and then tell me whether you think they were good or bad. I'm proud of the fact that I was able to do more for this district than anybody in the history of this district, because I was fortunate enough to have the support of the public in this district long enough to rise to a position where I could do some good for the area. And so that's one benefit that that people have gotten from my service, even if they think that on substance, if they profoundly disagree with me. They got a right to do that. It's a free country.
We're going to squeeze in one more phone call. I want to go to Barb in Eau Claire right now. Barb in Eau Claire, you're on with Dave Obie.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I'll tell you something. Thank you so much, Congressman Obie. You've been my hero for many years, and I've been a great supporter of yours. You are a great fighter. You have worked for the people, and thank you so much. We will miss you so much. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. That's kind of you.
Dave, what's next for you now that you're retiring?
I do not know. I mean, I have not had any real time to consider it. I had to spend all of my time working to finish action on the budget items. And then we've had to I've had to put together we've got 42 years of congressional papers to sort through.
And Dave, we have to wrap it up. I see that I'm quickly running out of time faster than I thought. We want to thank today's guest, Democratic Congressman Dave Obie. I'm Glenn Mobergen for Kathleen Dunn. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning, Eric Janik, and Dave Potras for on-air production.